I want to welcome you this morning. My name is Justin, and I am one of the pastors here at Ecclesia. We're going to be in Psalm 33 this morning. So if you have a Bible, you're welcome to turn there. We have Bibles on the welcome table you're welcome to grab as well. You can also follow along on the screen this morning. But we've been walking through the Psalms. We take every summer just to have an opportunity to walk through the Psalms together. So we're walking through them in just a consecutive order, even though they don't naturally flow one into the other. We've just kind of started this a couple years ago, started with Psalm 1, and we're up to Psalm 33 today. Psalm 119 is going to be interesting when we get there. Let's try to do that in 1 week, right? But we're at Psalm 33, and it's awesome. I love this text. I think there's a lot that the Lord is going to teach us through this text and what he's going to reveal through this text about himself. And so I'm super excited to be able to teach this morning and walk through this together. I want to start off just reading the text together. And so you can, again, follow along, and I'll read it out loud for us this morning. And then we'll kind of jump in and break this down and give some context to this passage together. Psalm 33, shout for joy in the Lord, O you righteous. Praise befits the upright. Give thanks to the Lord with the lyre. Make melody to him with the harp of 10 strings. Sing to him a new song. Play skillfully on the strings with loud shouts. For the word of the Lord is upright, and all his work is done in faithfulness. He loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their host. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap. He puts the deeps in the storehouses. Let all the earth fear the Lord. Let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke, and it came to be. He commanded, and it stood firm. The Lord brings the counsel of the nations to nothing. He frustrates the plans of the peoples. The counsel of the Lord stands forever, the plans of his heart to all generations. Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord, the people whom he has chosen as his heritage. The Lord looks down from heaven. He sees all the children of man from where he sits enthroned. He looks out on all the inhabitants of the earth. He who fashions the hearts of them all and observes all their deeds. The king is not saved by his great army. A warrior is not delivered by his great strength. The war horse is a false hope for salvation, and by its great might it cannot rescue. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him, on those who hope in his steadfast love, that he may deliver their soul from death and keep them alive in famine. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield, for our heart is glad in him because we trust in his holy name. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in you. And so, what we have this morning in Psalm 33 is a traditional hymn of praise. This was used in worship frequently. It was recited often to remind those who are worshiping of who God is and what God has done. It was a reminder to give worship and to give praise to this powerful God. And what you're going to see in this passage is that it's really kind of broken down into three sections. It's a call to worship that we started our morning with here this morning. And so it's a call to give praise. It's a call to give honor. It's a call to give loud shouts and to play music and to sing to God. And then we're given this middle section of why we should worship and why we should give praise to God and what God has done. Why is he worthy of our worship? What is our motivation behind doing these things? And then it ends with a recommitment and confession that God alone is worthy of our worship. And so my hope this morning is that we would have an opportunity to be moved to worship. And I love just even like the setting of this morning, even what has taken place here as we began, an outpouring. I mean, there's a tangible presence of the Spirit of God in this room. And that's exciting. We get to celebrate that. We get to come and we get to be moved to worship. But we're also going to be reminded of why we worship and our motivation of worship this morning. And my hope is that we would not look to any other thing for our deliverance, for our safety, for our security, for our freedom, for our significance, for our satisfaction, other than God alone this morning. That we would see the significance, the weightiness, the gloriousness of God this morning. And so I've broken this passage up into four sections, and I'm basically going to answer these four questions this morning. The first question being, what does Psalm 33 teach us about worship? What does it have for us in regards to worship? What does it tell us that worship should look like? What does Psalm 33 teach us about God, the character of God, the nature of God, the power of God? What does Psalm 33 teach us about us, ourselves? What does the psalm teach us about us as mankind? And what does Psalm 33 call us to do as followers of Jesus? And so I'll begin with the first. What does Psalm 33 teach us about worship? And we're going to see here in verses 1 through 3, we're given this description and this call to worship that says that we are to shout for joy in the Lord, O you righteous. That we're to give thanks to the Lord with the lyre, that we make melody to him with a harp of 10 strings, sing to him a new song, playing skillfully on the strings with loud shouts. And so what I want you to see out of the gates is that what we're asked to do in this passage can be seen in venues outside of a worship gathering like we see this morning. Shouting, praising, music. One of the places that my mind kind of goes to, just because we're like in World Cup season, I remember when we first moved to Salt Lake City, I had the opportunity to take one of my sons to our first Major League Soccer game. We showed up, Real Salt Lake Stadium, we walked in, and immediately I was just taken back of just how much praise and worship was happening in this arena. I remember walking in and just going, this is the greatest sporting event I've ever been to, all right? And it wasn't because of what was going on the field. It was because I began to look at these people, and I'm like, they are excited. They're worshiping. They're giving praise. They're singing these songs and these chants, and everyone's cheering, and they're all doing it together. And I'm like, man, I want to be a part of this, right? It just drew you in. And there's a sense in which that when we look at that, I don't think we naturally go like, hey, they're worshiping. And but that's exactly what it is. They're shouting, they're giving praise, they're giving their voice to these things because it's like there is something exciting going on. Now, what's interesting about that is no one had to be taught to worship. No one had to be taught like, or go to like worship 101 class. I didn't, you know, before walking into Rio Tinto Stadium, I wasn't like given a description like, hey, so here's the songs we're going to sing. And just want you to know if like someone takes off and scores a goal that you're supposed to stand up out of your seat at that point, raise your hands and go, woo, you know, and yell. No one had to teach you that. Like, you naturally respond to that. And so everyone is worshiping something. It's the object of our worship that we want to look to this morning. What are we worshiping? What are we giving our attention to? What are we giving our shouts to? What are we giving our praises to? What are we giving our singing to? What are we offering sacrifices to? Everyone worships something. Salt Lake City as a whole is made up of worshipers. It just differs in what the object of our worship is. The second thing we're going to see is that worship encompasses all of our being. You may read this text, and if you were to take this text literal, you would be like, give thanks to the Lord with the lyre. You're like, I got to go find a lyre. Like, you're going to KSL classifieds, and you're like, lyre. I guess I can't be faithful. I can't be obedient to this text because I don't have a harp of 10 strings and I don't have a lyre. So how am I supposed to be faithful to this text? And ultimately, it's just the sense that when we worship, when we give praise to something, it's to encompass all of our being. It's to affect our body, where we actually make music with our body. The truth is, when Jesus grabs your heart, it should affect the whole being. So that when we walk into a traditional worship gathering, let's go back to Rio Tinto, like there is a activity going on. There's something that draws you in because you see that there is something taking over their bodies, that they stand and they give praise and they're worshiping and they're lifting hands and they're giving high fives and they're chest bumping, and it just makes you feel like, wow, this is awesome. And my question is our worship on a Sunday morning, or even a Monday morning, on a Friday evening, does our worship look anything like that? It's to encompass all of our being. I remember, I've shared this once before, but I keep this picture, and it's just a great reminder to me. When I was in college, there was a major conference, Christian conference event that was happening every single year called Passion. And I remember when I was in college, I had the opportunity to go to Shelby Farms, Tennessee, where tens of thousands of believers gathered on this, basically farmland in the middle of Tennessee. It rained all weekend. I remember my tent, there was a constant drip of rain that just dropped on my forehead as I slept. But it's like, man, we're sacrificing for the Lord. This is awesome, right? And we're here, and people prayed over this field the entire time. And then the one day event, we got to walk onto this field and worship. And it was a day of worship and excitement. And I just remember just being like, this is it. We've arrived. This is true worship. And someone took a photo. I don't know how I got this photo, but I have a photo printed, and it's a picture of me from behind, and it's just hands lifted, and it's just fully engaged in this worship event. And I keep that because it's a reminder. It's like, man, Jesus, at that moment in time, was just so overwhelming. It affected my whole being. That I was okay being a little bit uncomfortable. That I was okay just standing and giving praise and lifting my hands, because it just took over me. And my question is that what our worship looks like? When we gather here on a Sunday morning, is it encompassing our whole being? I loved what one scholar said as I read this week. It's interesting that we're to make music. It doesn't say hum to the Lord, it doesn't say mutter under your breath to the Lord. It's we're to make music. And it's interesting, music evokes so many emotions, right? You listen to a song and it takes you back when you were in high school, and you're like, oh man, that was my first heartbreak, right? You're just drawn into it. And, or you remember, you read this song, you hear the song about, this old dog, and you're, reminded of, when your dog died when you were 12, and you're, crying in the car, and the kids are like, Dad, what's wrong with you? It's like, nothing, So it just brings so much emotion. It's interesting that, God has used music as a way in which we give praise. We gather on a Sunday, and we have music. Have you ever thought about, why do we do music? Why do we sing? But there's something about when we engage the body, that those emotions follow. We're not to be afraid of emotions. There's a lot of people in the church culture today fear all emotions. It's all intellect, all wisdom. It's God created emotions, and so it's okay to be emotional. And I love what, like I said, one scholar said, that music is useful for awakening the minds of men and moving their hearts. And we need our hearts moved. We need our hearts changed. And so when we engage our body in worship, the heart follows. Some of us are fearful of, I'm stepping in, I'm doing the motions, But the heart isn't following. I'm just going through routine. It's going to talk about that. It's saying that we're here in just a second. It's going to talk about that our worship is to be skillful. It's to be accurate. And so we're not just like, it's not just an emotional fanaticism, like we're just like crazy and we're just singing and we're like, you know, foaming at the mouth. I mean, it's like there is to be accuracy. There's theology that's driving our worship. And so in this, it's like when we come together and we engage in worship and singing, eventually the heart follows. We don't, you know, you don't live in a relationship with your spouse or your kids and you're like, I'm supposed to love you, you know, because so I'm going to go through the emotions. I have to do this for you because you're my wife. But as you begin to serve him or her, and as you begin to love, those emotions begin to follow. The same is true in our worship. But we're to be skillful at it. It says, sing to him a new song, play skillfully. I love the new song. It's a sense of, I just read that and I think like this sense of like freshness, a new song. We sing old hymns, right? But like there's a freshness, there's a creativity to them. There's sense of like, I want to sing new songs to the Lord because there's new things that he's doing all the time. That it wouldn't just be old news. That I wouldn't just get over the fact that he came and he changed my heart and he totally changed the course of my life. Like, I want to continually see his hand at work in my life and bringing new songs to him. But we're to be skillful on the strings. We're to be skillful. We're to be accurate. There's a sense of where, I remember I was reading one guy this week and just talking about this passage and playing skillfully. There's a sense of where we can be overly skillful and all concerned about skills, that it's a performance. And we don't want our worship to be that. But on the other side, we don't want our worship to be like if Garrett was up here and everybody's playing in whatever key and he's like capoed 4 or whatever, and then like, oh, I shouldn't have been capoed 4. And you recognize it's distracting. So there's this sense of we need excellence in our worship, but we also don't want it to be a performance. We also don't want to be distracting in our worship. It's to be accurate. I love when just talking about the accuracy and the theology behind our worship, that theology drives our worship. We were talking in staff meeting a few weeks ago, and I went back and looked it up this week. Matt Redman wrote a song called The Heart of Worship. And it's interesting, if you look at the story behind the song, what's interesting is that Redman's congregation, his church, was struggling to find meaning in its musical outpouring at the time. He said, there was a dynamic missing. So the pastor did a pretty brave thing. He decided to get rid of the sound system and band for a season, and we gathered together with just our voices. His point was that he said that they had lost their way in worship, and they wanted to get back to the heart of worship, and so they would strip everything away. Because it become distracting. It was just music without meaning. It was just noise without any type of significance or focus on Jesus. And so he reminded his church that they are to be producers in worship, not just consumers. He said, when you come through the doors on a Sunday, you're bringing an offering to God. And he said, initially, it was like embarrassing silence because they were singing a cappella and these heartfelt songs. But they started encountering God in a fresh way. And he said, before long, we reintroduced the musicians and sound system as we gained a new perspective that worships all about Jesus. He said, when the music fades and all is stripped away, and I simply come, longing just to bring something that's of worth that'll bless your heart, I'm coming back to the heart of worship, and it's all about you. We are to be accurate in our worship. Worship is to be skillful. But I love this last part. If you come to my house, you would know that our house is full of loud shouts. We're a loud people in the Bindle household. All right? And our worship is to be loud. Some of you are here this morning like, I wish that sound guy would really turn it down. I've heard somebody before say this, if God can hear your inner thoughts, then why does the worship band have to be so loud, right? Like, if he knows the inner thoughts, if he knows you're waking, it's like, why do we have to be so loud? It's like, because we've been commanded to. We give so many of our shouts to lesser things. But yet, here we come on a Sunday morning, we are to be loud, to be noisy with our worship. I looked it up, and I remember the first, again, another sporting event here in Utah. We visited, it was before we moved here. I got Jazz tickets on, like, ticket stub or something, like, for $5. It was ridiculous. I'm like, we're going to an NBA basketball game, $5. I soon recognized why. Because when I went in, it was like the crowd was not into it. It was the most lame sporting event I've ever been to. I'm going, why don't they like play music as they dribble down the court or something? Like, get people into it. It was just dead. And I remember just sitting there going like, this is super lame. There was no responsiveness. There was no activity. And I love that he commands us to be loud. He's commanded us to be active in our worship. He's commanded us to give shouts. And so I pray that we would do better than the 12th man in Seattle, Washington, or the Kansas City Chiefs. So these are like the two loudest stadiums in the world. I pray that our worship would be louder, that we would not give our shouts to lesser things. What does Psalm 33 teach us about God now? I love this. So you jump into 4. We've had this call to worship. Why do we worship? Well, because the word of the Lord is upright, and all his work is done in faithfulness. One of the motivations for our worship is that his word and his work are inseparable. This is such good news to us. That his word, whatever he says, he has the full power, unlimited power to actually carry it out. That it's not empty. Like, I could tell my kids, I look at, you know, their fears. And, you know, Lila Kate, you know, she's in her bed at night and she says, Dad, I'm so afraid. Like, I could in that moment be like, no, Daddy's got you. Like, I'm going to protect you. But honestly, those are empty words, because the truth is I can't protect her from everything. I'm limited in my power. I'm limited in my knowledge. I'm limited in my abilities and skills to be able to come alongside her. So I truly can't do that. Her hope is not in me. And so ultimately, what's good news about our Father is that his word and his work are inseparable. What he says actually comes to, like, fulfillment. When he tells us in John 14:3 that I'm going to go and prepare a place for you and I will come again and take you, so there you may be also, we can have firm confidence that that's going to happen. We can know that that's going to happen. His words are never empty. The second thing is we see we're surrounded by good gifts from our Father. He says in verse 5, he loves righteousness and justice, and the earth is full of the steadfast love of the Lord. I love that passage when I read that. Like, I highlighted the word full. Because I think so often I look around in our world and I don't see the goodness, the steadfast love of God. I see brokenness, I see pain. And so it's good for me to know, one, his words and his works are inseparable. But two, it's good for me to know that the world, if my eyes are open and I'm looking, that I will see into this world, that the world is full of the steadfast love of God. My question is do you believe that this morning? Do you believe it's full of that? I just pray that that would give you great hope this morning, that the world is full of that. He also, we understand about the character and nature of God, that he's powerful. It says, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their hosts. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to take a deep breath in and exhale. The world was made. Boom. By his breath. Do you sense the power in that? his strength in that. I love this. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap. Okay, so have you ever tried to grab water? It doesn't really work, right? You grab water, it goes right to your hands. Grab, like, you can't use your hands as a cup, right? But somehow, God is powerful that he gathers the waters in a heap and he can hold it. It's pretty fascinating, right? Don't know anybody else that can do that. I'm going to worship that guy, okay? Like, that seems like somebody I want to give my praise to. Somebody that can do something that nobody else can. And his power is most evident in the fact that he does miracles of transformation every single day. He takes a hard heart and he softens it to make it aware of the things of God. That he takes brokenness and he brings healing and reconciliation. That we could never be reconciled to God apart from Jesus. He has the power to do that. He is powerful. John Piper, talking about the omnipotence, the unlimited power of God, says this: if we believe this, if we really let this truth of God's omnipotence get a hold of us, what a difference it would make in our personal lives and in our ministries. How humble and powerful we would become for the saving purposes of God. The omnipotence of God means refuge for the people of God. And when you really believe that your refuge is the omnipotence of God Almighty, there's a joy, a freedom, and a power that spills over in a life of radical obedience to Jesus Christ. When we know he is all-powerful, when we know that his word and his work are inseparable, there's an overwhelming sense of peace and affirmation in our obedience to Jesus. It's good news. The other thing that I love, like the character of nature of God in this, is that his eyes are upon us. He is not unaware. No matter how wicked, how broken, how dark the world may seem, it's not that God's eyes cannot penetrate that. And that either brings a lot of comfort or it brings a lot of fear. That his eyes see all. I love when, in verse 13, how often it uses all. The Lord looks down from heaven. He sees all the children of man. From where he sits enthroned, he looks out on all the inhabitants of the earth. He who fashions the hearts of them all and observes all their deeds. That could be scary, right? And so, like, we see this sense of all. Like, there's nothing that, like, it's not like he's on a part-time job, like, oh, I miss that, you know? Like, no, he is fully engaged. His eyes are fully engaged on you, on your life. And that either evokes fear because of the things that you think you've done that are beyond repair or the things that are beyond grace and forgiveness. Or that brings great hope in the midst of tragedy and trial because you're like, God, do you even know what's going on? Are you aware? And he's like, yes, I'm aware. I know the awesome things of your life that you would love to have on a movie reel played in front of everyone. When you helped that old lady across the street the other day, you know, like, we want to play that one. But, like, the deep, dark secrets of our life is, man, I don't want that exposed. Well, the truth is, he knows that and he loves you. He's passionately engaged with you. And that's why he had to make the ultimate sacrifice of his son Jesus so that he could bring you into relationship. He knew those things. That's why he gave of his son as a gift to you. So what does Psalm 33 teach us about ourselves? Well, what's interesting about this is we're kind of comparing and contrasting this almighty, unlimited power of God to what we want to think, like, I have power, the power of man, when in reality, we're pretty weak. And we know that, and that's what's going to cause anxiety and fear in all of us. So what does this teach us about ourselves? We lack power. Verses 16 and 17. The king is not saved by his great army. Doesn't matter how many people you have on your team, You're not saved by your great army. You can be defeated. I watched a movie recently. I'm always late to the game, so I watched a movie called 12 Strong, and it's an awesome story of, you know, basically these 12 men who go on horseback, which only like one of them had ever ridden a horse before, and they go, and it's one of the greatest defeats against the Taliban, where they took on somewhere in the range of like 20,000 to 50,000 people, and they were like 12 men on a horse and a small army, like the Northern Alliance going with them. I mean, it's a crazy story, because you would look at this story and be like, they're significantly outnumbered. How many stories do we read in the Bible of where they were significantly outnumbered and God gave them the victory? We easily can hold these things and be like, this is my power, this is my strength. But the truth is we all lack power. Two, we all look to things to give us power. So it says in this text that the king is not saved by his great army. A warrior is not delivered by his great strength. The war horse is a false hope for salvation, and by its great might it cannot rescue. These are all false hopes. And the truth is we may not have armies or horses or strength or kings, but the truth is we all have very symbolic things in the very same manner that we're looking to give us strength and power so that we can be self-sufficient, dependent of any person, and really not need God. And the truth is all of us are looking for that. That was the first fall with Adam and Eve in the garden. That Adam and Eve, they took of that. They were looking for power and knowledge, but ultimately they were looking for freedom. That they were looking to be self-sustaining, self-dependent. And the truth is we all look to things to give us strength. These are all false hopes, though, because ultimately we know they can never save. At the end of the day, when we lay our head down at the end of the night and we lay our head on our pillow, we recognize that we're very limited. And as much as we try to like muster up strength and power and want to encourage ourselves in those things, we are lacking. And we need something outside of us to give us strength. I was reading a story of John Piper this week, a pastor, and he talked about like sitting down and writing a sermon. He said, Lord, I have a text, I have an idea, I have a mind, I have hands, I have a computer, I have health, I have energy, I have a free day, I'm free from any interruptions. And if I rely on these things, these good things that you yourself have given me, then what will the people get on Sunday morning? What can a man produce? He said, Lord, they don't need another man-made thing. They live with man-made things all week long. What your people need, what I need, is something beyond what man can make. Something supernatural from you. So I renounce reliance on these things. I know the text is good. I know my mind and fingers and computer and health and energy and freedom, these are all good things. But I renounce reliance on them and I look to you. And I ask that in and under and over and around and through all those good things, you work so deeply and so decisively and so graciously that what I say on Sunday would not be the work of mere man, but would be the work and word of God. But that is what God wants all of us to do. He wants all of us in more and more areas of our life to consciously rely on him and not on ourselves and not on our own human resources. My question is what are you trusting in for power? What are you trusting in for significance? What are you trusting in? What are your horses, strength, armies, kings that you're looking to uphold your little world? I look back over like my life and this week and I was just reminded, like, I started this week super discouraged, if I'm honest with you this morning. Like, I started this week just discouraged with, like, where I desire our church to be and where we are and like what I want to see happen and what I'm not seeing happen. And I was thinking, I was just like, all of this kind of hit me at once. Here in a few weeks, I have an opportunity to go back to Texas, where we moved from 4 years ago, and I'm going to stand before a congregation, and my goal in that morning is to cast vision for why they should continue to support Salt Lake City, and like, here's all the things that are happening that are so great. And in that moment of discouragement, I was just like, man, what do I have to say? Like, and it was just a sense of just overwhelming, like, oppression and just a weight. And I joke with, like, our team. I'm like, yeah, I think I quit today. I think I signed back up. And I'm back being a pastor today. And, like, these are, like, the deep, dark secrets of a pastoral heart, right? Like, we always want to quit on Monday. And but Sunday, we're like, all right, let's go, let's do this. And it's just this cycle that we're on. And I just remember sitting there on Monday and just kind of speaking this discouragement to my wife. And of just going, man, what can I do? Who can I get? What do I have at my disposal? You know, I have education, I have training, I have strength, I have energy, I have an entrepreneurial spirit, I'm an achiever energizer, I'm confident. You know, like, I got all these good things. Surely I can create something with this, right? Like, surely I'm gifted. Surely I can do all these things. And as I began to, like, account for those things, it just kind of created more anxiety and more fear and more weightiness and more discouragement. And I just sat there like, oh, it's all up to me, though. Like, if I have to do this and it's all up to me, it's all in my strength. And this is where my wife typically comes in. And she goes, hey, have you prayed about it? I'm like, of course I prayed about it. You know, like, there's just a frustration. But, like, I don't want to pray about it. I want to fix it. I just want to do it. I don't want to wait. And I just look back and I go, you know, this isn't where I've always been. I remember when we first arrived in Salt Lake City. I mean, there were times where we used to live just a few blocks away from here. And every Sunday morning, I would walk to the gathering. And I would use that time to pray and to talk with God and basically just confess my need for him and just beg. And there was a desperation that, God, I need you to show up this morning. If we do all that we can do, we're still going to be lacking. This city will never be saturated with the good news of Jesus if it's not for his work. And I just remember there was a sense of where that was real to me, where I was desperate, where we got together regularly and we would pray and we would beg of God to show up. But somewhere along the way, like, as more people came to our gathering, as more people jumped into missional community life, as more people began to call this place home and like, man, this is awesome. The Spirit of God is here and we just love being a part of it. There's a sense where I became very foolish and just started kind of walking to the gathering like, oh, I got this. I remember for most of you, like, think about the first time you did something. You're like, God, if you don't come, like, if you don't show up. I remember the first time I ever preached and you're like praying. And then you got up and you like went through all your notes in like 5 minutes. And I was like, what in the world? Like, I thought I had 45 minutes here, you know. And you're just praying. And then eventually along the way, there just comes a point where it's like, dude, I've preached hundreds of sermons. Surely I can stand up and do this, right? Like, I got this. And I just want to confess this morning, so often, I think I stand in this pulpit, and what you get is you get Justin in his own strength and power. And I'm sorry for that. And I confess that to you this morning, that I'm asking, would you pray for our staff and our team in that? that we would not rely upon our kings and our armies and our wisdom and our seminary degrees and our, you know, experience in pastoral ministry, that we would not rely upon those things, that we would come to a place where we go, I have nothing to bring. God, come. We need you. Show up. So pray for me in that, but I would also ask you the same. What are your kings, armies, horses, and strength? What are you relying upon? Is it in your finances? That if your bank account just has this number, then you would be confident. You would feel strength. You would feel like, I got this. But there's almost a place, and I wrestle with this, of going like, if I had this much money in the bank account, then I would be okay. And it's because at that point, I almost feel like I don't need God. Like I have margin. So it's like, hey, if everything goes south, I at least got 6 to 8 months, right? Dave Ramsey gets 6 to 8 months. You know, so I'm like, I'm good to go. I don't need God because I'm resting in what's in my bank account. Maybe it's in your relationships. I don't need God because I have these friends, I have these relationships, I have these people that are close to me, that know me, that I get to spend time with. Is it in your knowledge that you're just gaining more and more wisdom? Is it in your experience? What are your kings, armies, horses, and strength? I pray that we would not be dependent upon anything but the power of God. So what does Psalm 33 call us to do as followers of Jesus? Well, verse 18 is good news to us because it says, behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear him. And I want the Lord's eyes all over my life. I want him to protect me. I want him to look over me, that I want him to demonstrate his power on my behalf. I need that. And I love that his eyes are upon me. But what do we do? Well, 20 through 22 gives us what do we do in light of this text? How do we live as followers of Jesus? Well, it says, our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield, for our heart is glad in him because we trust in his holy name. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us, even as we hope in you. And so verse 20 says it's waiting, that we're to be patient in his provision. So often I want to fix things now, but we're to be patient in his provision, that he is our help, that we are to call out to him, that we need him. As I kind of described in my walking to the gathering on Sunday mornings, that there is a confession of our hearts to saying, God, we need you. We need your power. 21, for our heart is glad in him. We can come to a place where we rest in confidence as the Lord gives us power. That is where resting comes in. It's not when we have 30,000 soldiers or $30,000 in the bank account. We're to rest in confidence as the Lord gives us power. And then verse 22, let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us. We receive the love of the Father. And this morning, I hope that this has been space, that you have come and you have received the love of the Father. Because as we receive that, it turns us back to a place of worship. And so we confess together. In the next few moments, as we just pause and we partake of communion, that we would rest in his steadfast love. We would rest in knowing that his eyes are upon us. We would rest in knowing that his word and his work are inseparable, that he has all power to accomplish the things in our life, so that when we're anxious, when we're stressed, that we wouldn't go to our kings and armies, but we would stop and pause and say, God, we need you. I love the picture of Jesus. Jesus gave up all of his power. Why? To receive the power of God. When Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, Satan was basically offering him power. And I think many of us put in that same position, we would have taken it. Because it gives us freedom to not be dependent upon anything. It's like, hey, I'm going to give you, I'll stack your bank account. I'll put you over these people. I'll give you the resources you need. And it's like, oh, okay, I'll step into that. But what we're missing out on is the provision of God the Father. Jesus perfectly modeled this for us. As he didn't step into the temptation to depend upon these other resources, he depended upon the power of God. So my hope this morning is that we would set aside our power and receive God's power this morning. Let's pray together. Father, we love you and thank you for this text that gives us this call to worship. And I pray even as we come and we partake of this table, communion, as we break this bread, as we picture your body broken for us. It's just a picture here of brokenness, of just a willingness to submit to the Father. And I just pray that we would come with broken hearts and willingness to just say, God, we need you. And I'm thankful that we don't have to look any further than the cross to know that you are a provider. You have provided in the most difficult situation. We could never be reconciled to God, but you did the work. And so we come to the table this morning resting in that work, celebratory in that work, and giving praise to God the Father who sacrificed all so that we may be one. We love you. We praise you. Thank you for the opportunity to come and worship this morning. In Jesus' name, amen.